This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
I want us to just look a little bit as why this odd thing, you know, unfolded that one particular bishop seemed to garner, you know, final authority in the church. And like so many things, it didn't happen over time. And a lot of historical events, I think, contribute to what unfolded here. The big picture is during the 3rd through the 5th centuries, the western part of the empire is going to experience repeated invasions from the Germanic tribes. And by the end of the 5th century, the imperial power of Rome would be gone forever. And I think one of the biggest answers to the emergence of this ultimate power vested in the Bishop of Rome himself is there was a vacuum in the West. And it was rather natural for the head of the church in that area kind of to step into that that role. One of the early signs of the demise of Rome was the Battle of Adrianople in 378 when the Visigoths defeated the Roman army. And when the city of Rome itself was captured by Alaric in 410, it was just the beginning of the end. Later, the Huns and the Vandals would also sack Rome, and the last Roman emperor in the West was deposed in 476. Now, some of this took place during the life of St. Augustine, and the catalyst for him writing the City of God was the destruction of the city of Rome. And the Christian world was absolutely devastated by this, and they just couldn't believe how God could allow these pagans and these Arians to come in here and to destroy our churches, our homes, and to take over the West. But if you look in your textbook, there are some good maps there and describe where the different our Germanic tribes ended up spread throughout Europe and the British Isles. Now, while the emperor in the East remained very powerful and had contact with these German tribal kings, most of them were kind of independent sovereigns in the different areas, but typically they would swear allegiance to the Eastern emperor because they were still incredibly powerful. The Germanic tribes did not try to tangle with the Eastern emperors because they certainly could not have handled that. So usually there were treaties made, and because the shift of the seat of the empire to the east had taken place, that they were able to have some kind of relationship there, that the Eastern Empire would last for another 1,000 years. Now, most of these Germanic tribes were Arians. By this time, they had been influenced by the spread of these ideas. Eventually, the good news is that these barbarians would be converted to Orthodox Christianity, but it caused quite a challenge to the Orthodox in the West for a season. Christianity would survive the fall of the Western Empire, but the unity and stability in the midst of this chaos as the empire comes unglued in the West was really provided by the administration and organization that the church could provide, and fundamentally through the person of the Bishop of Rome himself. By this time, the church owned vast tracts of land, was rather wealthy, and could meet some of the basic needs of society. And so really stepping into the gap. Thompson says this, "The philanthropy of the church," he's talking, "was so highly developed by Constantine's time that it gradually took over the care of the poor and the needy throughout the empire. In its care and under its auspices, there was now developed for the first time in human history a definite and systematic scheme for the relief of human need. In addition to poor relief, there were organized monasteries, deaconries, hospitals, hostelries, orphanages, poorhouses, refuges, homes for the aged, homes for infants, and infirmaries, a type of institutionalized social service unknown to the pagan world." And so classical Roman culture would also continue through the influence of the church, Roman art, Roman architecture, the use of the Latin language because of the prominence of the church in the West. And this hierarchical church government that had emerged would be something that both the Church of East and West would continue. Kenneth Latourette, the 19th century historian, comments this way about the breakup of the old Roman world and what took place. Christianity even proved to have profited by the breakup of the Roman Empire, for in the West, largely freed from the latter, it eventually displayed renewed vigor in a long series of fresh creative movements. Christianity continues to bear the imprint of its Jewish heritage and the Greco-Roman world into which it first moved, but it has proved the capacity to outlast cultures. And really what we've seen thus far with the roots in the Jewish heritage, then to the Greco-Roman world, and now the diversity of many different cultures in the West. And so Christianity now continues to be shaped and formed by the cultural context in which it lives, and where this helped provide a season of uniformity with common language, common culture, as the West will break up into these smaller kingdoms, beginning with the Germanic tribes. We're going to see a period where there's going to be reunification in the West under the great Germanic king Charlemagne, but then it's going to happen all over again. And it's really this whole period, as we move out of the patristic era into what we call the Middle Ages, and the first portion of that, the Dark Ages, that the church is dispersed in more and more among different ethnic groups and cultures. But in the midst of that, the Roman Church would provide some stability. And even in the context of the breakup of the West, most Christians in the West wanted to maintain their link with Rome, because this was the connection to the ancient church. And it was in Rome where so much of the church's identity was found there. And if you just think about all those elements that we identify with the city of Rome itself, it was the capital of the empire in the West. The martyrdom of the great pillars was identified there. The Roman symbol, Apostles' Creed, identified with the Rome, the first versions of the canon with Rome. And so all of those things combined to focus attention there in this one place. So when you talk about the emergence of the papacy, you can't divorce that from history and what really transpired. And it really appears quite a natural thing that happened, that this one particular bishop, who was had a collegial relationship with all the other bishops for a number of centuries, all of a sudden gets thrust in this position of preeminence. And then you add to that a number of the men who occupied that office, who then began to began the road of a power grab. And given that position, then began to claim for themselves even greater and greater authority, power, and influence. Some of it used for good, some of it not so good. But from the very beginning, though, most of the fathers had recognized the unique role that the bishop in Rome had. And while these other bishops in Jerusalem and Alexandria and Constantinople, Antioch, were significant, Carthage were significant individuals and leaderships, they, in some instances, did defer to the Pope at Rome. It had this ambiance of being kind of the mother church of ancient Christianity, and so they deferred courteously. But they also felt free in the early centuries to disagree with the Pope. They didn't like what he did, they let him know about it, and so there were some struggles over who's going to have the influence. And especially before the time of Constantine, you find the regional bishops pretty much did what they felt, you know, God wanted them to do, and they were inclined without the connectedness. But at least in the Eastern Church, under the umbrella of the strong emperor, the connectedness of the bishops became fundamental to the life of the church. And this is why they could pull off these ecumenical councils. They could have never done this in the West because of the historical context. But the East, they could. And that's why the great ecumenical councils are took place in that area. Well, the Bishop of Rome and his power began to increase into the 3rd and 4th centuries. And some of the popes there, I want to point your attention to some individuals that uniquely enhanced, I think, the reputation of the papal office, Innocent, Leo, and Gregory. Now, sometimes Leo and Innocent are variously referred to as the first pope, and I guess that's kind of a subjective thing. In other words, some of the broad-reaching claims that they began to make. But I really don't think until you get into the 5th century, historically, it's fair for us to ever even talk about a pope. In other words, a person in the East, in the West, who could claim unilateral power and supremacy over a huge section of the church. And those claims, began to emerge as the empire in the West began to dissolve. Innocent insisted during his time as the pope that all major disputes in the church must come to him. Where we have evidence in the early times, this was kind of a voluntary thing. Often they would seek the wisdom of the Bishop of Rome, but here he's insisting, no, all of it's got to come to my desk. And he made a point to try to push his influence in the East too. This is the other characteristic that we see here, even though you would think that the bishops in the East, being right in the shadow of the emperor there, would have more preeminence. But the Western bishops were often contending with that, and the Roman bishop was trying to stick his hand in Eastern affairs. In fact, during the ministry of John Chrysostom, when some of the Eastern bishops condemned him, kicked him out, the Bishop of Rome was the first to step forward and support John Chrysostom, wanting to exert his influence there, and Innocent did that. He did have some influence in dealing with the Donatists in the West also, which contributed to the reputation that he had. Now, Leo the Great greatly enhanced the Pope's position, and he is one of the first ones to emphasize this primacy of St. Peter. When we talk about the Petrine theory, that is the doctrine or belief about why Peter is the head of the church, so to speak, the earthly church. He is one of the earliest ones to appeal to Matthew chapter 16 to support his views that the church is built upon Peter. He exercised significant power in the Western Empire, but very little in the East. He desired to see the church unified under the Roman bishop, and certainly tried to enforce uniformity in the West as best as he could. He was able to procure an edict from one of the last Western emperors that ordered all to obey the Roman bishop as having the primacy of St. Peter. And you can look that up in Bettinson. It's there. Valentinian was this Western emperor who described this primacy of Peter, that all, this was by, imperial decree, that all must submit to St. Peter. But according to tradition, it was Leo, Pope Leo, the one who actually negotiated with Attila the Hun and talked him into leaving Italy. And there are a number of instances where in the vacuum of military power that the popes really almost had to step forward and be heads of the army and represent the military and negotiate with these attackers. Constant tension, though, east and west between Rome and Constantinople. Now, a bold exercise of power by Pope Felix III was to excommunicate Acacius, the Patriarch of Constantinople, in 484. This is known as the Achaean Schism. This is one of the earliest times that you find east and west at loggerheads over who gets to call the final shots. Acacius. Yes, he is the patriarch in the East, and it's Leo the First who excommunicates him. No, I'm sorry, Felix the Third. Pope Felix the Third excommunicates him, and it caused no little dissension between the two. And interestingly, it was over an issue related to Christology, and so there was some compromise taking place in the East with some of the Monophysite churches. Monophysite churches were those that believed that Christ only had one nature versus two natures, and Felix censured the patriarch in the East as he was trying to accommodate some of these Monophysites. Well, this little spat between East and West lasted for about 30 years, but eventually ended in a papal victory. And again, the Bishop of Rome was on the right side of orthodoxy. Repeatedly, you know, over time, the bishops of Rome, almost without exception, whenever there was theological controversy, always tended to be on the right side. And that was, again, you know, one of their great claims, that God has preserved the truth, you know, in the West. And even with the Council of Nicaea and the great battle with the Arians, the bishops of Rome consistently maintained Nicene orthodoxy. Most of the Arian influence was in the East, and the tension. In the West, they concurred with the Nicaea. It was not as much their issue, but consistently they seemed to be on the right side. Now, Gregory the First, or Gregory the Great, he's the one I mentioned earlier who gave his prudent insight about what form of worship should you adopt for the Christians in Britain. Very powerful pope, even though his reign was not incredibly long, all of 14 years that he was pope, but he certainly used his time judiciously and brought great stability to the church in the exercise of his authority. He tried to combat political corruption. He took over ownership, the care of the poor in the area of Rome. He is one of the popes that actually raised an army himself and made peace with the Lombards on his own authority. There's nobody else to do it, so he had to. And really had a passion to reach the pagans, initiated not only mission work in England, but also among the Arian Lombards. He wanted to win these Germanic people away from the Arian heresy and to the Orthodox faith. He also exercised papal authority in France and in Spain. And Gregory made this declaration. He said, "By the Lord's voice, the care of the whole church has been committed to the holy apostle and prince of all the apostles, Peter." The political and ecclesiastical authority exercised by Leo and Gregory were the high points of papal prestige. Both used their power politically to rescue Rome from being overrun by barbarians, and ecclesiastically they solidified the organization of the church in such ways that it enhanced uniformity of practice and heightened the preeminence of the Roman See. And as the empire continued to crumble, the popes filled the function of the old Western emperors. And out of this new cultural context, the rise of papal power unfolded into what we might call the Roman Catholic Church. That's another thing I would say, in addition to, by the 5th century, starting to talk about the Pope, which just simply means Papa, but this official title of the head of the church. Really, we can begin by the 5th century to talk about the Roman Catholic Church. It's really a parallel, I think, development along with this distinctive role that the Bishop of Rome would have. We can begin to talk about the Roman Catholic Church. Up until this time, that nomenclature was not used so much. And so it would become a distinctive, you know, of the Church of the West and its identification with Rome. So here, those are some of the very influential popes. You know, if you want to do your biography on Gregory the First, for example, he is a unique individual. We have a number of things that he wrote. We have Leo's great tome, T-O-M-E, where he defended the Orthodox doctrine of the Trinity. If these individuals would be of interest to you for your biographies, you're certainly welcome to look at some of these men. Well, the natural question, if we think about, all right, how did this this role then of the unique papal authority emerge down through the centuries? And the best we can tell in the practice of the church, it seemed to unfold in these general categories down through the centuries. And we've already traced a number of these notions. The idea of the monarchical bishop is the idea that in individual churches, there would be one bishop for each church. And one church in a community where they would gather to worship on Sunday is distinct from elders and deacons. That's what mono, one, in one church, one bishop, which for us would be the clergy person. you know, in that area, the one who administers the sacraments. As you move to the third century, you begin to have bishops. There are not as many to go around. You'd have a bishop who was the head over multiple churches, usually in a smaller area. This is what you call diocesan bishops. Some traditions continue to talk about dioceses as a part of their understanding of the role of bishops being in that way. And then your metropolitan bishops in some of the chief cities, the larger ones that had influence. And some of the metropolitan bishops later on would be referred to as archbishops, kind of big bishops, if you would. Those that, because they were in the big cities and there may have been many smaller churches around these huge metropolitan areas, that they became some of the key leaders that the churches in the outlying areas would look to. So the metropolitans. And then the five patriarchal bishops, the five key places. And then as we move into the 6th century, you've got this very competitive situation where Constantinople and Rome are pulling on each other. When we talk about the major bishoprics in the ancient church, we're talking about these five. And it is true that in Constantinople, it was a practice sometimes to refer to it as the New Rome. And so that competitive sense that, you know, the whole shift of power has come east. But the thing that's important to remember when you're talking about the five major sees of the bishops, notice that four of them are in the east and only one in the west. And you're talking about in these four areas, you're talking about Greek-speaking people. In this part of the empire, you're talking about, at least ecclesiastically in the church, that Latin was the common language. When the scholars and the bishops would write declarations, the service was in Latin. Latin was still the common language. Again, a carryover from the Roman culture. So not only did you have the cultural difference and this numerical difference of 4-1, you had the language difference, and these things would began to have a momentum of their own, where the east-west division that would eventually take place in the 11th century happened in segments over time. But as the empire crumbled, then the western bishops then would declare their authority. What were some of the benefits of the papacy? Even those of us who would disagree with how all of this kind of played out and not feeling like it was necessary for the life of the church, yet in its time, we certainly can objectively see some benefits to Christ's body at this time that emerged from this. Help preserve and spread Christianity in Europe. And, we might as well own up to it. It's the missionaries that many of these popes sent out that converted our ancestors. Really, if you trace those of us of European and descent particularly. And then it's the work that they were passionate about, and the bishops of Rome took that over. Filling the vacuum of power, defending the church against barbaric plunderers, and then protecting the church from heresy. All things that we have mentioned, but seeing that in the providence of God, there were some good things that came out of that, although it laid the bedrock for such a powerful ecclesiastical position that could succumb very easily to corruption and vile behavior. And that's going to play out some very serious ways in generations that would follow.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole for sale or for profit without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.